Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast for January 20th. It's brought to you by One World Sports. I'm John Gibson, and joining me in cyberspace is Jim Allen. What's up, buddy? How you doing?
I'm doing well. It's cold in cyberspace today.
It's early in cyberspace today, too.
Well, I guess it's, it is early. We're recording Sunday morning instead of Sunday night, but same hot stuff to talk about. I mean, it's baseball, whether it's January, February, June, or July, it's still baseball.
Yes, and we do have some really hot topics today.
We do indeed. Some explosive topics, almost.
Our special guest this week is Jerry Krasnick of ESPN. We're also going to discuss the Coco Ballantyne situation and the Hall of Fame and answer some great listener questions. So let's get started.
Clearing the bases!
All right, so on Tuesday evening here in Japan, the time was, I got to talk to former Denver Post national writer and the author of License to Deal, Jerry Krasnick. And we missed you. You were supposed to participate in this interview,
yeah.
And you weren't able to just because of work obligations,
yeah,
which we understand.
My agent was holding out for a better deal.
Your agent. Okay, good. Yes, just like the producer, the guy who's the producer on the show here, always thinking of and worrying about the time. Yeah, the agent. Well, that's good. You'd let him know that we did miss you and we could have used your input in the interview, but I think it went well. Jerry was fantastic. He's a well-respected and long-time baseball man in the States and one of the most knowledgeable persons we could have the honor of having sit down for our little humble podcast.
Yeah, he's very succinct, which is nice to hear from a writer when they're speaking. Writers can be very succinct in print and very, very much like me when they're talking. Never use 5 words when 20 will be more difficult to understand and be more technical and hard to grasp.
Just like right now.
Ooh, I did it again. Stop it.
Well, Jerry was very gracious with his time. It was evening here and he woke up early. He probably wakes up early anyway, but he woke up early to talk to us and we appreciate having the opportunity to talk Japanese baseball with him. So let's go ahead and take a listen to the conversation. All right, with us in this episode is Jerry Krasnick. He's the senior ESPN baseball writer. And first of all, it's a real pleasure to have you on the show this week. Thank you very much for taking the time this morning to talk to us.
Good to be here, John.
All right, well, we're going to offer you the opportunity to put aside all the Hall of Fame ballot selling talk, the steroid talk, the A-Rod, and the Goofy Cubs mascot talk. And we can chat about something fun, Japanese baseball. I'd like to first ask you your impression of Japanese baseball, and especially for you, but among maybe some of the other media members in the States.
Well, look, I think obviously people take the quality of baseball in Japan very seriously. And we've seen some real impact guys come over through the years with Ichiro and Godzilla, Hideki Matsui, and Yu Darvish. So, that's a testament to the quality of baseball over there. I think most writers like me, I guess if you were to try to talk about the type of baseball that they play in Japan, I think the sense is it's probably more of a small ball approach. You know, maybe there's less of an emphasis on the big slugger and the home run and more on moving runners and putting the ball in play, maybe not so much power pitching, you know, upper 90s like we get here. A little bit more nuanced maybe than the baseball over here. Doesn't necessarily make it worse or better. I just think it's a little bit different. And obviously, I think when we saw with Bobby Valentine and some of the other guys who came over, there are some adjustments just with the way they train in Japan and some of the things they do to get ready for the games compared to the players over here.
That's true, and there hasn't been a real impact power hitter who's come over from Japan. All I can do is reference Cecil Fielder, who came back from Japan and hit the cover off the ball.
They don't hit as many home runs over here now as they were either, for obvious reasons. I mean, with cracking down on PEDs and amphetamines and some other things, we're not seeing the kind of baseball we saw here in the late 90s and early 2000s either.
Right.
But still, I think when you look at the prototypical American slugger, you think of Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa. Now it's probably Chris Davis and Miguel Cabrera, but we're not seeing many, you know, 50 home run guys. I guess we had Davis and we had Jose Bautista, but that kind of style of ball has really passed a little bit here too. And pitching, the pendulum seems to have swung back toward pitching a little bit more.
Now, in terms of Japanese baseball, is it a real gray area for reporters over there when you hear about some player? Is it hard to find information on them?
Yeah, it is a little bit. I mean, I wish that when it comes to, say, Latin players, you know, a guy from Cuba or a guy from the Dominican, they're usually – there's a few scouts that I know who've done this for a long time that you can access pretty easily, and those guys are great. I mean, they'll tell you exactly what they think. With Japan, sometimes it might be a guy that I know over here who said – you know, I might ask him off the cuff, well, what do you think of Masahiro Tanaka, or have you heard anything about him? And he'll say, yeah, I was actually over there, you know, looking at some guys, and I saw him. So it's a little bit hit or miss. There are a few scouts that you know are tuned into Japan or Korea who might be able to give you a scouting report on a guy. But that's sort of the route you have to take. You know, you have to search a little bit to find somebody who's seen the guy. And that's really the best way you can go about it. At least now with things like Skype and texting, it's a little bit easier to get a hold of a guy, because of the time difference. Sometimes you might want to talk to a guy and it might be 3 or 4 in the afternoon your time and he's asleep.
You
have to try to coordinate that a little bit, and that's really no small thing.
No, it's not. No, it's not. I know it very well. You know, part of the reason that I contacted you in the first place was that we've always complained, we being the media over here, that there have been so many erroneous reports in the States, and we can't figure out why reporters get the information wrong, because some of it's out there in English. So that's why I asked the question of the gray area. But how do you go about finding information on Japanese players other than stats-wise, other than talking to scouts and other than talking to other reporters?
Well, look, that is the beauty of the Internet. I mean, you can go on there and Google a guy's name and find pretty much everything that's out there. And the other thing is, one thing that I've found recently is, if I go to, the general manager's meetings or the winter meetings, there's a lot of reporters from Japan. And those guys get after it. I mean, they really, the one thing I've always found amusing or different, at least from here, is that, say when, Ichiro first came over in Seattle.
That's an extreme case. Ichiro and Nomo, I think they were really extreme cases, yeah.
Yeah, well, they would have their own individual beat writer, right. You know, the guy, he would know everything about what Ichiro did every single day. And so when you come across these guys, they're pretty good. I mean, you know, they'll tell you, you'll say, hey, what's this guy like with the media? And they'll say, well, he's a good guy. He deals with us well. And this guy is sort of aloof and doesn't like to talk to us. And so, I mean, I probably should make more use of calling, the Japanese media. To be honest, I think with language barriers a little bit, like I credit these guys, they can speak English. Well, I can't speak Japanese, but there's still a little bit of difficulty with inflections and sort of understanding, you know, me talking to them and them talking to me. I think there's a little bit of a barrier.
Definitely.
But these guys are pretty good. I mean, they can be very helpful. Like I said, when I was at the meetings, you know, when I would ask about what's Tanaka, you know, going to do, or what do you think of Tanaka or this guy or that guy. They're very wired in. They do a lot of work. So the one thing you find just from coming across all the Japanese reporters is how crazy people are about baseball in Japan, especially compared to in the U.S. where it's popular, but it's football mania over here. And baseball has kind of taken a back seat to a couple of other sports. And in Japan, I don't think that's the case. I think baseball is the main thing over there.
Yeah, baseball and soccer are pretty popular. Yeah, yeah, that's true. Now, I remember when I was living in Nagoya at the time, and I was doing some stories on Nomo when he went over in 95. And one of my friends at the LA Daily News was Ken Daly. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
I know Ken, yep.
And Ken said to me one day, he said, Gib, he used to call me Gib all the time. He said, Gib, we need you over here. We can't, you know, we can't get enough out of the translator to do an interview with Nomo. And I said, yeah, I'd be glad to come over and help you. You know, Nomo has this really difficult lisp to understand. He said, he has a lisp? You know, I never knew he had a lisp. And, you know, and, you know, I told him, you know, Ichiro is really a man of few words anyway. So if you can really get him to talk, it's, you know, it's like taking a can opener and getting a, you know, opening a car with it, because it's going to take you a while to get it open with that guy. But like I said, I've been covering for a long time, and I've been seeing a lot of Japanese players go over. But what I really wonder sometimes is, how do you guys, if you get the numbers, if you get the stats, how do you quantify those numbers in terms of the hitters and the pitchers? And then how do you project what they're going to do in the States?
Well, first of all, I did want to mention, since you mentioned Nomo, I have a kind of a funny story about him. When he was with the Dodgers, I was in Denver, Colorado. I was the national baseball writer for the Denver Post. And one night, I was working on a project. I wasn't covering the game. A couple features. We had a baseball section we put out. And I had to go to the park that night to interview some players for this, you know, these big picture projects that I was doing. And I went to the park and did my interviews, and the weather was horrible. It was raining, and I said, you know, I'm not going to sit through a rain delay because the game won't start for 2.5 hours or whatever.
This is the no-no.
And I go home, and I turn on the TV, and I watch Nomo pitch a no-hitter against the Rockies. And I could have been there for the game, but I said, because I think the game probably started a couple of hours late at least.
Yeah.
And I remember just being captivated by watching this guy with this corkscrew motion and, you know, just amazingly captivating guy throw this no-hitter. So I know that's a side story, but it was a funny sort of personal experience I had. Yeah. As far as what you said about projecting, I mean, it's hard enough to do that even with us, with, say, a player in the draft or a player in the minor leagues.
And you have so much more information, right, with those players.
Yeah.
You have a lot less with the Japanese players.
It's sort of difficult to say, hey, Tanaka went 24-0 or 24-1 over there, so is he going to go 19-6 over here? It's kind of difficult. The one thing I think we tried to do is, you know, with guys from, say, the Asian countries, Ryu came over last year, and, you know, one of the writers from L.A. said, he sort of reminds me of David Wells or this or that. You looked at him in spring training and you said, okay, guy doesn't throw particularly hard, but he's left-handed. He seems sort of crafty. He knows how to pitch. He's got good deception. So I remember them asking in spring training, like, what do you think he's going to do? And I said, well, I think he's going to go 11-8 with a high 3 ERA or whatever. And actually, I don't think it was too far off.
It was pretty close, I think.
Yeah. Right. You know, I think with Darvish, for instance, he's probably exceeded expectations. With Matsuzaka, you know, he came over, did pretty well, but didn't quite seem to adapt. So there are so many things with the learning curve with these guys that go beyond just the baseball. You know, how they're going to deal with the travel, how they're going to deal with pitchers pitching more often. How's a hitter going to deal with seeing cutters or certain pitches that he didn't see over there? So it's really tough to project. I think you just look at talent and say, hey, Hideki Matsui can hit. You can see him in the box. You know he can take a pitch. He can pull the ball. He's got some power. You try to make projections that are on the conservative side, and sometimes they exceed it. And sometimes they don't, you know, and he was a guy who did well. Ichiro, obviously, I don't know that anybody would have anticipated him getting close to 3,000 hits over here after 10 years in Japan. But he's just an amazing talent, and his ability translated to the American game just as well, just because he's such an artist with the bat.
Yeah, I think I had a conversation with somebody. I said, well, you know, in the States, they're going to throw more fastballs. They're going to pound the strike zone more. And this guy, he knows what the strike zone is, and he's really good at getting the bat on the ball and hitting strikes. I mean, you try to, when you're pitchers, you're trying to get guys out with balls that look like strikes a lot of times but aren't. And you know, he's good at getting the ones that aren't strikes, and he's better at hitting strikes. So, yeah, I thought he would do well over there. Now, everybody wants to know right now, the hot topic is where's, and we call him Ma-kun over here, but Masahiro Tanaka. Where is he going to go? And I saw something in the newspaper over here, one of the Japanese papers that said he's going to be the 17th over here, which would be the 16th in the States, that he was going to decide what team that he was going to sign with. But I just think that's rumor that this newspaper is printing. But what team do you think has the best chance and why?
Well, look, over here, I think there is a little bit of a mania over here. People are very excited to see where this guy's going to go, not only because of him, but there's a lot of other pitchers over here, Matt Garza and Irvin Santana, like
David
the free agent market.
David Price.
Has been at a standstill for pitchers because of him. I think the consensus is that the Dodgers just have so much money they can throw at this guy if they want to. And for him to pitch in Los Angeles, you know, they've had experience with Japanese players. It's a market that you would think would be very appealing to him. He could have a huge following there. So they certainly seem to be, you know, a force to be reckoned with. And there's a lot of excitement over the Yankees. You know, I think for him to go to New York, the Yankees, look, they have some extra money. As you probably know, Alex Rodriguez has been going through a few things here.
Right.
And they have a real need for a starting pitcher.
Definitely.
You know, they have CC Sabathia and Kuroda, but Kuroda's getting older.
Well,
Nova, you know, they really, they've done a lot of things to their team, but they really need a frontline starting pitcher. And the thing about Tanaka is he's 25 years old. So, you know, it's not like you're going out and getting a guy. When teams go out to get a free agent pitcher, free agent pitchers don't come on the market at age 24 or 25. So I think there are some concerns by people about his workload and some of the, you know, pitch counts that he's piled up. But he has enough promise. You know, most people I talk to say they don't think he's quite as good as Darvish, but he's fairly close. You know, I mean, he could be the next notch down, and even if he is, that's still a number one, number two starter. I'd say right now, you know, the Dodgers and the Yankees seem to be the main teams. The Angels have been mentioned, but Jerry DePoto, the Angels GM, just said that they didn't even meet with him when he was over here.
Mm.
There are some other teams that are interested, like Arizona, Toronto, Boston, the Cubs, but I just don't know that they're willing to go to the $100 million plus level that say the Angels or the Yankees would. So to me, if you're going to pick front runners, the Dodgers and the Yankees, I think you have to pick the Dodgers and New York as the two teams that would seem to be the most likely landing spots for them.
Yeah, I've been blogging about that since last year, and that's what I predicted. And I actually predicted that the Yankees, who said they wouldn't be outbid, and I think I wrote in a blog post recently that $125 million contract is not out of the realm of possibility, maybe more.
Yeah, look, I mean, the one thing about this was they did an open bidding process, and when you look at other pitchers, you know, Cole Hamels, Matt Cain, if somebody thinks he's in that level, we've seen guys, Adam Wainwright, you know, close to 100 million. They're all clustered in that sort of 100 million to 140 million, Zach Greinke category. So Casey Close, who's his agent, is a pretty astute guy. I'm sure has all the comps of other pitchers in that category, and he's running those out there, and he's going to use this, you know. In New York, there's a lot of pressure on the Yankees, I think, to do something because everybody keeps saying, oh, they're going to get this guy. He's going to plug into the rotation. Well, if they fall short, they're probably going to have to overpay one of these other pitchers that they don't like as much. You know, they might have to give $80 million to or $90 million to Irvin Santana. So
well,
maybe
David Price's...
hey, we'll go an extra 10 or $20 million more than we wanted to, and we'll get the guy that we really want.
Right. David Price is still on the trade table, I believe, right? So they could maybe make a move for him if they have.
He's.
I know it's in the same division.
He could be traded. I think Tampa Bay, if they're going to trade somebody, the consensus is they probably wouldn't do it in the division. If they're going to trade David Price, they're going to get him out of the American League where they don't have to see him. And the momentum for that thing really seems to have stalled a little bit. I don't know that teams are willing to quite. The one thing about Tanaka is he's going to cost a lot of money. David Price, you might have to empty out your farm system. And I think teams would rather spend the money on a 25-year-old pitcher that they think could be really good for another 6 years, five, 6 years, than a guy who's going to be a free agent in 2 years and you're going to really have to give up a lot of talent for.
All right. Well, you talked about the no-mo, no-hitter at Colorado, which was a game that was on live here that I watched. So you went home, but I stayed with it. I hung with it and watched it. But when did Japanese players really come on your radar as being potential stars over there in the major leagues who broke the mold over there?
Well, I would say No-Mo was certainly big. I mean, he was a guy because of his not only the way he pitched, but as I said, his motion, he had sort of a way of going about it that certainly caught your eye. And Ichiro was big. You know, I remember going out to spring training when Lou Piniella was there and Ichiro had showed up. And Ichiro was there slapping balls to the left side. And, you know, the people in Seattle were sort of like, you know, this guy is the guy that we're all excited about. He's a little punching Judy hitter and, you know, they're going to be able to knock the bat out of his hands. And I think somebody said, hey, try to turn on a couple balls. And the next thing you knew, he's blasting these balls over the right field fence.
Right.
You know, he could really do that when he wanted to. And people said, oh, my God. And here's a guy who won, what, MVP and Rookie of the Year the same year in 2001. So I think No-Mo for pitchers certainly blazed a trail. And Ichiro for hitters, you know, there were some players – before that, but then you get Hideki Matsui and then you get Darvish. And so not all these guys are going to be stars, but look, I mean, to me, if Ichiro were on a Hall of Fame ballot tomorrow, I'm going to vote for him for the Hall of Fame here. So, even for his accomplishments in Seattle, notwithstanding his accomplishments in Japan together,
right?
He's a sort of a seminal figure in baseball history, really. Other than Pete Rose, there's probably not been anybody who's that much of a just a born hit collector.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a good way to put it, too. Obviously, yeah, the hitters are hard to quantify, and we haven't seen many go over to the States and have a lot of success. But when you hear about some Japanese player potentially coming over to Japan, what's the impression that you get? Do you think that this person is automatically somebody who's already a star in Japan and is going to come over here and come over to the States and try to make it? Or do you think that this is a player who needs to prove himself?
Well, it probably depends on the level of the guy. You know, I think with a Darvish or a Tanaka, they come with so much hype and so much of an investment that you can't help but think they have to produce immediately to justify it. I mean, when Yu Darvish gets a $51 million posting fee and a $60 million contract, and Texas has committed over $110 million, he better pitch well. You don't want him going to the minor leagues, you know? So it's the same, say, with guys from Cuba. You know, when Aroldis Chapman came over, everybody had high expectations for him. The Reds sent him to the minor leagues, you know, but with some of these guys, you know, if Tanaka comes over and struggles at the beginning and they had to send him to the minors, people are going to proclaim him a bust before he even gets started. So he better be ready to contribute right away. But he's the exception, I think, rather than the rule. You know, any other player who comes over isn't going to get the same money, isn't going to get the same attention. So for that guy, maybe you allow for a little bit more of a learning curve for him to really adjust. But for the guys who get the big money, they're just like anybody else. They better perform right away because that's what everybody expects.
Yeah, you bet. Now, this story is about 24 hours old on the news cycle. When I woke up in the morning, I saw something on Twitter and then went to Facebook and saw that Vladimir Valentin had been arrested for a domestic violence incident. But put that aside for now. Let's just concentrate on his contributions on the field. Now, what do you and your colleagues make of what he did with the 60 home runs that he hit here in Japan last year?
Well, you know, I think he's a guy who over the years always had the power. You know, I think for him, it was probably a question of making contact. I remember when he broke the record, I did a story and I went back and on YouTube, there was a clip of a home run he hit for Cincinnati and it went into the upper stratosphere. I think it was up into the upper deck.
Mm.
And George Brand, I remember the Reds broadcaster, he was at a loss for words, you know, had how far the guy could hit the ball. So I think he always had the power, but for a guy like that, he's probably, you know, has problems with the breaking ball and some other things. And so for him to go over to Japan, look, I don't want to devalue it too much, but from what I understand, I don't think it was a great year for baseball in Japan. He probably took advantage of some inferior pitching. So he's a guy who I don't think he's that great a hitter in terms of he'd have to do that for several years and maybe even come back over here and hit 40 to sort of validate that in the minds of people here. But 60 home runs is 60 home runs. I mean, it's still a major achievement and it was exciting to see. Obviously, this latest news is pretty sad and disturbing. You hate to see that happen. But, you know, as to what he did last year, I think people looked at it and were willing to celebrate it to an extent, but I don't know that anybody went completely overboard on this and was ready to proclaim him one of the greatest home run hitters of all time based on one really, really good season.
Yeah, that's basically, we know that he had a good year. We've seen him for the previous 2 years get better in each season and lay off a lot more breaking pitches out of the zone and get more discipline at the plate. And, you know, like I said about Ichiro, he's really good at hitting balls that are near the strike zone, but he's excellent at hitting balls in the strike zone. And I think that's the case with a lot of hitters. I think no matter what part of the world you're in, I think that's always going to be the case. If you can swing at strikes, you're going to have some success. So yeah, obviously we've been in Japan watching Japanese baseball and the World Baseball Classic for us, the first two, obviously with Japan winning and us being so immersed in Japanese baseball, we understand that it's not a 4A league. It's a little bit higher than that in some respects, but in other respects, you have guys who probably wouldn't make it in double A who are playing on the top level sometimes over here just to fill in. So we know it's a different class and a different level of ability over here, but we're hoping that people understand that Japanese baseball is pretty good. And eventually I think Tanaka and some other guys, who played in the WBC last year will probably be moving over to the States fairly soon. So look forward to them. Anything you want to know, shoot us an email and we'll let you know about them.
Yeah, it's great to know you guys are over there keeping an eye on it. And I tend to agree with you. I think the sense is that, look, there are probably plenty of players over in Japan who could come over here and have an impact. I think it's probably a case of depth. You know, the 25th man on the roster, that's where maybe you see the difference. But every time a guy comes over here, like a Yu Darvish or an Ichiro or a Matsui, or maybe Tanaka, we'll see with him. I don't want to say validates, but I think it does give more credibility to the league in Japan and really makes people think, yeah, you know, I think it's best for everybody when these guys come over and are successful. You know, it's good for the Japanese teams. My only concern would be, I guess, when these guys come over, you don't want to see MLB raiding the Japanese rosters and buying all the best players and, you know, having them all leave because you want to maintain the viability of Japanese baseball. So, you know, you want to have some of your really good players stay over there.
Sure, yeah.
It's probably a personal decision, too. I mean, it's a major jump for these guys. They have to leave where it's like when a guy leaves here and goes over there. He's leaving his origins. He's going to a different culture. You know, I wrote a story last week about Niger Morgan who went over there and wants to come back. And, you know, some guys go over there and do really well and some guys wash out and immediately come back. So, like I said, there's a lot more to it than just the baseball.
Yep. All right. Thank you very much for taking the time this morning and chatting with us. We appreciate it. And, we'll look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Thanks, John.
All right. Happy New Year.
You too.
Okay, again, Gary, thank you very much. Thanks so much. It was really good to talk to you and good to get your opinions and thoughts on Japanese baseball.
Yeah, hopefully next time, you know, we'll get this set up so that my agent isn't getting in the way.
Agent again here. You give me this guy's number, man. I'll handle this for you.
Wow.
I think I think the producer needs to talk to your agent.
Agent pays my paychecks, you know.
Well, yeah, after he takes his portion.
Indeed.
All right. Well, I'm sure this was a long conversation. I'm sure there were a lot of things that stood out for you. What really grabbed your attention first?
Well, I think I'll start at the top and talk about, you know, what reporters, you know, there's this, you know, we're all in the business of sharing of gathering and sharing information.
Mm.
People who are the best at communicating, of both collecting and communicating are the people at the top of the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the difficult thing is we're asked often, and, you know, in fact, scouts are a big part of our food chain
mm-hmm.
for us writers. And I was thinking, wow, Jerry talks to the same people that I talk to, which is the major league scouts. I get the best information I get about Japanese players is either from Japanese coaches or major league scouts or the other one that he mentioned, the Japanese beat writers.
Yeah, I mean, it's no surprise we have similar sources. That's certainly what we do. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing is, of course, that watching the players, which is, you know, listening to you and Michael and you and Patrick.
Patrick Newman, the MVP tracker.
Correct. Talking about different things and watching. I mean, I watch players too, but I, you know, my background's a little different. The things I look for are a little different. My experiences, you know, our experiences are all different. But anyway, going back to the point of it's interesting to see that even though we're in Japan, that the sources are the same.
Mm.
And, you know, people ask me, you know, what is this? What kind of a pitcher is, you know, they ask me the same questions. What kind of a pitcher is, what can he do in the major leagues? And I asked the foreign players in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
A big thing about Masahiro Tanaka this past year was talking to Casey McGee and Daryl Rasner and Andrew Jones about who's similar. Who does he remind you of? What does he bring? What, you know, to be honest, at the end of the day, the answer is he's not really like anybody. He's like Masahiro Tanaka. But there wasn't any doubt that once he makes it, he'll have a bunch of adjustments to make, but he's as good as anybody to make them.
Right. And obviously Jerry said the same thing. He said when it gets down to it, you can look at the numbers, and Malcu had the 24-0 record and the ERA and struck out this many. But when it gets down to it, the eye test is what people eventually go with, and it's really impossible to project what these guys are going to do, which I agree, but I'm sure there's some projections. There's some people who are doing some projections because they're also doing a lot of math to figure out how much they're going to pay the guy.
Well, yes, and here's the other thing, and I think where the conversation, there seemed to be, well, obviously I had some input into a couple of the questions that John asked Jerry, and I was thinking about those, the answers, and it seemed there was a slight gap.
In the answer or in the question?
Well, in the understanding or what we were talking about, because essentially there is a gap in the sense that I wanted to go back to the Coco Ballantyne issue, which is that when a guy hits 60 home runs in Japan, what does it mean to you? It's almost like a trick question. And it's a trick question because is he ready to be, you know, what's he going to hit in the major leagues is a loaded question.
Yeah,
and it's a loaded question because if you're in Japan, people still think, yeah, it was the ball, or they're looking for excuses. You look for excuses when somebody you don't think can do something does something.
Excuses.
And this is
No
excuses, essentially.
Okay.
Oh, why he couldn't be as good as you didn't think he was.
Okay.
And that's the standard. I mean, it's really hard to get out of that with Japan. And again, I'll go back to the thing. If he did it in AAA 20 years ago, people would have done the same thing. You know, he hit those in the Pacific Coast League. He's as bad as we thought he was. He's just, it was a weird thing.
Mm-hmm.
He's not really a good player.
Right.
Because they don't want to challenge their old adjustments. Now, he did a very rare thing. And I think this is where you come across in Japan, is that knowledge gap is so huge that, you know, you can talk to the scouts, and the scouts are absolutely the best people because they come and watch the guy and they see the kinds of successes and failures he has, which is what you absolutely have to do. But that gap is so huge that you still can't get over, you can't get over the bias that you have against players to begin with.
Mm.
You can't get over the labels. Now, the difference between 20 years ago and now with the minor leagues is there's so much information available about what players do in the minor leagues. This whole concept, which I'm not certain it started with Bill James, but the idea of a replacement level player, and this is not wins above replacement, but, you know, the kind of guy who's freely available.
Right, the concept of a guy who's...
Yeah, who you could pick off the waiver wire, essentially.
Right.
Is very important because we know there are so many guys who are better than that now in the minors. And we know that because we're sharing this information, and Bill James is a big part of that 30 years ago. Actually, I should say 30 years ago this would have been the case. But now, like I said, I'll say again, if he had done that in the Pacific Coast League, every team would have said, well, how much is he going to cost us this year to get Coco Ballantyne? Instead of saying, well, I heard the ball in Japan isn't really very good, and the pitching isn't really very good. You know, instead of looking for excuses, they're looking for answers, which is what they do now with guys who are unexpected talents in the minors.
Mm-hmm.
But still with Japan, they, number one, somebody did something amazing. Let's find a reason why the bad things we thought about him before are still valid.
Right.
As opposed to how is he succeeding, it's why is he still a failure? So that struck me as still being a part of the, and I don't blame Jerry because I think it's really ingrained in baseball. You gotta see a guy before it works, and if somebody does it out of your sight, you have to be suspicious. And he said rightfully, you have to tone down you have to make conservative estimates about what people are due.
Right, and we remember last year that, of course, we didn't have a juiced ball, but the stories that I saw stateside said that the ball was juiced. They didn't get it accurate. It wasn't the specs on how the ball was made were slightly deviated from the previous 2 years in
right.
favor of hitters, but it wasn't a juiced ball. It was just just carrying a little bit better, and that's. But the stories we got, or that we saw coming out from stateside, was that the ball was juiced. And
right.
so that's,
and obviously
it sounded like that's what he was had in mind, that the ball was flying, you know, was flying out of the park. And I don't know if he was specifically saying that pitching in general was bad, or just he took advantage of some pitchers who weren't as good. But I think we have to go through all the home runs and see who he hit him off of, because I remember.
I think my assessment of his comments were, I think, very accurate. I mean, having looked at Ballantyne's season, I think he was fairly spot on, and I think Ballantyne has excelled at he's almost to a slight degree. We have a phenomenon in baseball where you get older players in AAA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get 27 and 28 year olds, usually guys who've been to the major leagues, who really they become so good at AAA, and they become so good at exploiting pitchers who don't really belong in AAA,
mm-hmm.
with and running up their numbers. So sometimes you'll see these guys who are 27, 28, 29, 30-year-old guys who are beating up on 20-year-old kids.
You stop it, you.
Exactly.
Pick up somebody your own age.
I know, it should be a felony. But these guys run up big numbers, and most of the major league scouts – and here's the problem that the major league teams face. Is this guy real, or is he just beating up against the kids? Okay, and I think now what you have with Coco Ballantyne's case, and to some degree a lot of the major leaguers come over here, is you have the same phenomenon. But here, there's an extreme reward for being able to beat up on the kids, which is multi-year, contracts that are worth $7, $8, $9 million that you're not going to get in AAA. They're just trying to get a major league job. You know,
right.
This was Scott McLean. I have nothing. I love Scott. He's a great guy. But if you're a 28-year-old in AAA, that's really all you can do is, you know, jack up your numbers. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. That's the only thing you can do. I mean, that's what you have to do. And you have to learn to play the game as well as you can. So anyway, I think to some degree this happens in Japan. You learn to exploit. Matt Winters said when he faced Hideo Nomo, Matt Winters was a very successful slugger here for the Nippon Ham Fighters. He said, when you faced Hideo Nomo, you just knew you were going to strike out twice. You looked for a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And then you waited for the bullpen to come in. because you didn't expect to get a hit off him. You focused on the things you could hit, and you just sort of like, okay, I'm going to take a loss. I'm going to take a loss today, so I'm going to live with that. I'm not going to get down about it. I'm going to look for a mistake and try to hit it and then wait for another guy to come onto the mound.
Right. And, you know, these are things that obviously the reporters in Japan, in the States, they don't come over. They haven't seen a lot of the players over here. They don't know. But one of the things that stuck out in the interview for me was, you know, him not having seen Japanese baseball, I don't think, in person per se, maybe outside of the World Baseball Classic. He seems to have the style of play down really well.
Yeah, well, that travels. When Japan goes abroad, they bring their bunt, you know, they bring the bunt book and the bunt bats with them.
Yeah, and of course, the reason I actually reached out to him last year was because when Coco Ballantyne did break the record and I started seeing stories on ESPN and AP and other places, they had gotten the home run wrong. I believe he hit a 2-run homer. They kept calling it a 3-run home run. And I think it was Yuichi. Yuichi was on base, on second base, and came home to score ahead of him. So I couldn't figure out why, because as Jerry said in the interview, the internet is allowing people to find out just about anything, just plugging in a name and all that. And I'm, why are people getting something so simple? You know, why are they all getting it wrong? And so I'm not sure that you can find about anything you want. I think you can find out a lot of information on some Japanese players, but certainly not the kind of numbers and the kind of details that teams want and that teams look at and that scouts and people like Jerry Krasdick would want to know.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, we're essentially, we're not because of the language barrier.
Yeah.
You can find that out if you can speak
Japanese or type it in.
Right. But or read Japanese to more to the point. But you need to ask people, who've been there. You need to ask more than one person who's been there because, you know, off the cuff, somebody will tell you this and you don't know whether everybody knows that or the guy's just speaking off the cuff.
Yeah.
So you have to go to the sources. You have to be more rigorous than you have to be as rigorous as you. Here's the thing. You have to be as rigorous as you would be if the guy was playing, whether the guy's playing for the Hiroshima Carp or the Washington Nationals.
Yeah.
And the point is that if you're writing about people in Japan, that level, you know, I've seen this, and it's not, it's pretty much, nobody cares. You know, I'll come out and say it.
Oh, that's true.
Editors over there don't care whether you get something wrong about a guy who plays for the Carp, because nobody from the Carp is going to stand up and make a fuss about it. But there are people, and I can't speak about anybody's writing getting wrong, because it's generally, it's so easy to be wrong. It's almost impossible not to be wrong, to be honest. You have to be extremely rigorous in something that nobody on your side cares about. So I'll say people like Ian Brown, who's now with MLB.com, and people like Jason Stark, who've done outstanding stories on people in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not saying they're right and everybody's wrong, but they deserve extra credit for going to such great lengths to be right.
Yeah, because there is a lot of fact faulty fodder on the net that really we've got to correct it somehow. I don't know what more we can do. I've told everybody who I've contacted or I've been in touch with about the fact that there's a lot of information out there. If you guys just do some more research, you can find it. So, in terms of what he said about Masahiro Tanaka, I don't think there was any surprise for you that he said the Yankees or the Dodgers. But you know, he did focus on a lot of big name players when I talked to him about Japanese baseball, and he didn't, there was no mention of the likes of Tsuyoshi Shinjo, who kind of made a, who made a big impact, especially with the Mets when he was playing.
Well, he made an impact. I mean,
he was a big thing.
Well, he was a big thing. Oh, yeah,
it might have been more fad than form.
Well, the stylists certainly made out. You know, the stylists and hair people made out. Probably had a boom in New York because of him.
Yeah. Now, and he didn't talk about Sō Taguchi, who actually won a World Series. I think was the first one, right? And then Tadahito Iguchi won a World Series, and
sure,
and Noritika Aoki, guys like that. You know, the thing is that.
Yeah, nobody knows where these guys are going to fit in, and we don't know. Obviously, their games translate to the major, you know, they're going to translate somehow. We just don't know how they're going to translate.
Mm.
Basically, everybody leaves something behind. I mean, Ichiro left his walks and powers in Japan, his walks and home runs in Japan. Matsui left a lot of his home runs in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he kept his average, and he lost quite a bit of power in that transition.
Mm.
But on the other hand, he became a little different kind of a hitter. You know, he had always had the walks in Japan, but they went through the roof in the major league. So he found a really good trade-off. And these guys are the ones who have to find a trade-off now. Interestingly enough, speaking about the ball and such, the ball is a big reason why people were shocked that Noritika Aoki could hit. Because he was coming into an environment where he had had 1 year of that bad ball.
Right.
And all the players were struggling to hit it. You know, it knocked 20, 30 points off the average, off typical batting averages in 2011. And he's coming out of that. And they're saying, well, this is what he did last year, so. But essentially, he was in a major league context in terms, I mean, 2011 is interesting because it made everybody had to scramble to make adjustments.
Right.
And I think if you look at what people did in 2011, you'd see a lot of what they were capable of at the major league level to some degree, because not in terms of the physical demands, but in terms of the ability to make adjustments to, you know, to a Rubik's cube of changing contexts.
Yeah.
You know, we had the earthquake, and we had daylight games, and then we had night games that were with low energy saving light levels. And we had a new ball, and we had the umpires changed. Everything was different, and some of the team, you know, some players, their careers collapsed in 2011, and it really never recovered.
Imploded, yeah. Yeah, one more point, and then we got to move on.
I think two things. One is that I have to congratulate Jerry, and I know you know what a quality writer is when you hear a turn of phrase like, calling Pete Rose and Ichiro Suzuki the hit collectors.
Ah, yeah.
That was worthy of Raymond Chandler. I mean, that was perfect. It was eloquent and to the point, and you said something about that before the show that you should share with us.
Yeah, he made it sound like they were homeless guys out on the beach collecting cans or something, you know, just, you know, they actually, those guys make money. In the end, those guys are actually making
with metal detectors.
With metal detectors.
Stay away from my part of the beach. These are my hits.
Yeah, you can have anything under, well, you can have anything on the surface. Anything below the surface is mine.
Okay. Whoa, very nice. I like that. And the other thing is, I never really think, I guess where he opened my eyes a little bit was, I never now think of these Japanese guys going over there as having pressure to compete and succeed.
Mm.
I don't know about you, but I don't think about it because I think about the success they've had here. And the only exception to that where I thought this guy's going to be in trouble was Kei Igawa, and not because of the specific pressure of playing in New York, but the fact that he is so shy and timid off the field, or he appears so, I can't say what he's like, I don't know him personally.
Right.
But he appears to be so shy and timid off the field. He appears to be a wallflower. And in that respect, he was the one guy who troubled me. But most of the other guys are very hungry to play.
Yeah, I think that's what we're most exposed to being on this side of it, is that we see what the player has to go through to actually make the move. Like, even with Makun, he has been struggling the entire year, let's say, from the time that before the season he said, you know, if I have a good season, I'd like to go over to the States and be posted, to the time where at the end of the season, the team is sitting there saying, well, you know, we don't really like what the posting fee is now. We really have to reconsider. And the struggle that he actually has gone through to get over there. And so we think about all that stuff. When that guy finally gets on a major league mound, we're thinking, oh, he's finally there. We're feeling more relief than the pressure of having to perform. Yeah. But I think in Makun's case, just like Jerry said, I think if he doesn't perform and he ends up going to the minors, everyone's going to say, I was projecting 125, more than a contract of more than $125 million for him. And I think that's conservative. And, you know, if he gets a big, big money deal, that's pressure. That's going to be pressure.
Well, yeah, these guys, yes. But these guys face, yeah, they're going to have to listen to it. But here's the thing with certain players, and I think this is the thing with Hideki Matsui, Ichiro Suzuki is a little different because he was in his own world to begin with.
In more ways than one.
Well, yeah, and the other thing was Ichiro Suzuki is great because in this respect and that element of a player focusing on what he does, which is what you have to do to compete at that level, I would assume. You know, when he was in camp, it didn't bother him that people thought he couldn't hit in spring training because he was just doing the things, doing what he did.
Right.
Okay. But most of these guys, Hideki Matsui particularly, and Matsuzaka to some degree, and Tanaka, these guys are big, big stars, and they're used to that, and they seek that to some degree. Darvish does. I mean, with Darvish, it's a love-hate relationship with that kind of stardom. He loves it, and he's also nervous about it, but he's used to it.
Okay.
So, yeah, so they fit right into that.
All right. Well, we could talk about it all day, just like you said, but we got to move on. So thank you very much.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Jerry Krasnick, for joining us.
Thank you, Jerry, and look forward to joining the conversation next time.
Yep. All right. Now we're going to move to the saga of Coco Ballantyne. Now, this was break
saga.
The saga. On Tuesday morning, I woke up to one of my friends who works at AP in the States sending me a copy on my Facebook timeline of the story that they released about him being arrested for domestic violence and false imprisonment. And that was Tuesday morning. And so I tweeted that out early. And then as the story, you know, developed and we got more information about him grabbing his wife's arm and locking the door behind them in a room and all this other stuff, it didn't sound like the guy I've never seen Coco without a smile, even when he strikes out. And he's mad about something. He walks out to the outfield. He eventually has that smile again, you know, within a few minutes. And I've never, you know, I just don't picture him doing that. And even his wife had come on TV and said, hey, look, I don't know what made him get this angry, but he's never been like this before. And this is something that's really unique and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, he got bailed out. He had a press conference, which took place, and considering the fact that his audience is here in Japan, I thought it was kind of odd that it went off at 3 a.m. our time here, because I don't think anybody really in the States was watching, or that was a big deal over there. So I don't know why they didn't plan it. Maybe it was strategic by his lawyers. I don't know what it was, but we didn't get to see any of it. I think his lawyer did most of the speaking, his Japanese representative. I don't know what was going on. It was just really surreal to see him in an orange jail jumpsuit on the news and saying, you know, I play professional baseball in Japan to a judge. You know, it was really, really surreal.
Yeah. Well, I can only speak to how it played in Japan because I didn't see the press conference. I did follow the news, and it is hard to imagine him doing that. But I can also say that having been divorced and having gone and going through divorce, not proceedings, but...
You and me both.
Yeah, that it twists people.
Mm.
You know, you're put through an emotional ringer, essentially trying to tie up loose ends that were never loose before.
Mm.
And sometimes, you know, we get caught in not trying to be evil, but trying just to cauterize wounds.
I think we go into survival mode as well,
sure.
Emotionally. Yes. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah,
so I think things happen that people act the way they're not expected. You know, they're not people, no one's used to seeing them. And anyway, moving beyond that, the treatment in Japan was kind of interesting. The first thing I noticed, in fact, the first thing I noticed was in the news copy that I saw.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese media, when there's a story, they will sometimes, when it's a good story about somebody with a troubled past, there's two ways of dealing with it. And the first separation is whether it happens to a Japanese player or it happens to a foreign player.
Mm-hmm.
If it happens, let's say, Hideo Nomo, I'm going to allude to something we're going to talk about, which is Hideo Nomo was elected to the Japan Hall of Fame. Or he was, you know, his election was announced mm-hmm. on Friday. But there was no mention of Japanese baseball treating him like public enemy number one in 1995. He was the arch villain of Japan. There was no mention of that. There was no mention of how they crucified him
right.
in Japan. But it was just about what a good player and how much we always loved him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's the Japanese player success story. A foreign player's story, okay, so now if anything bad happened to him, it might be a different story, but with a foreign player, good or bad, you get the fact that in Japan, and I hate to say this, but a foreigner in Japan is essentially a rap sheet that is waiting to be filled out.
Mm.
We're basically all, we come without criminal records, or our criminal records are unavailable. And essentially, the moment we do anything perceived to be incorrect, or somebody has a grudge to bear against us, we're essentially arch villains that have been concealing our criminal past.
Mm.
So, the first thing we see, where you don't get these connections about Japanese players, you do get the first part of the story about Coco Ballantyne was the final two paragraphs of the story, which said, of every story, which said, last year, no sooner had the Rock 10 Golden Eagles signed Andrew Jones than he was involved in a domestic violence episode with his wife.
Right, and I that's the first thing I remembered. I knew that he had a similar domestic violence charge before camp last year. I don't think there was any big issue with what he did, but he was welcomed with open arms when he actually came over to camp. But there was no false imprisonment charge, and I think that's a big deal because that's a felony in the States. But I don't know the laws on how they work in Florida. I know every state's different, but go ahead.
Yeah, but the point was, this happened to Ballantyne. What other foreigners have done this? One of the presenters at the Hall of Fame the other day was Osamu Higashio. He's a Hall of Famer, and he introduced his former teammate, Koji Akiyama. Well, Higashio was famous as a pitcher. He didn't have much velocity, but he worked inside, and he worked really inside to the extent that he hit the most players in Japanese baseball history.
Mm.
Okay, now, one time a foreign player, Dick Davis with the Kintetsu Buffaloes, took exception to this, and he went out to the mound and punched him.
Yeah.
Okay, now there's a number of people can tell you a number of stories about that. But basically, it was replayed over and over and over again. And funny, Higashio didn't mention that at the Hall of Fame the other day. but in any case, a year and a half later, Dick Davis was arrested on charges of possessing marijuana. And every story was about, oh, well, that explains why he punched Higashio.
Right, right.
So everything is like that in Japan. I won't say everything. That's too broad a brush. But it's a common thing that we live with in Japan, was that we are just rap sheets waiting to happen.
Yeah. Now, I remember in 2010, in fact, I wrote a column about it, that the Chunichi Dragons condemned Maximo Nelson to the minors for half the season because he had a bullet in one of his bags that he brought over from the Dominican Republic, and he had forgotten about it. And it's just a bullet, and we know that no guns are allowed in Japan, but this is a bullet. And the idea that the team would send him down for just having a bullet, and this is a crime, I don't even know that it's a crime.
It
because
may,
he wasn't arrested. And he wasn't arrested at the airport. It's just that they detained him, and they wanted to know why he had the bullet, because they just maybe assumed that there was a gun to go along with it.
One would think.
And half a season, I think it's what's really going to be the test, and I'm glad I'm not a Yakult front office executive at the moment, because I think they're going to have a really difficult decision in terms of how they respond to this situation. I don't think, you know, I'm kind of glad my pay grade doesn't go that high, because I wouldn't want to make the decision. They have to decide whether to discipline Coco just because of the image, especially with the female fans, or to not discipline him because they want to win. And I think there's going to be some kind of discipline, but especially if he's innocent, because then he gets to come over and he gets to play right away. But if he doesn't, and he actually has to spend some time over there away from the team because he's going through a trial, per se, or because he's got court proceedings, that's a different story. And if they convict him, oh my goodness. I mean, this is a felony, this false imprisonment charge.
If he's convicted of a felony, he'll have to have a special waiver to get a visa.
Yeah, wow.
And so there's a lot of issues involved. If he's not convicted, then there are no issues with his visa.
Right.
Oh, so anyway, well, the team said it. Here's the difference between if you're basically a marginal pitcher. If you're a marginal pitcher in your team's outlook and you're Maximo Nelson, we're going to teach you a lesson. If you're a marginal Japanese player, if he was a marginal Japanese player, he might already have been released.
Yeah, he'd be ostracized.
Exactly.
Eviscerated.
He'd be looking for work with the Chunichi Dragons.
He'd never get work anywhere. He'd be eviscerated from the face of the earth.
Okay. No. They have a long history of picking up people who've been arrested on various misdemeanors.
Okay.
And rehabilitating them and making them successful baseball players at their former team's expense. Anyway, what happens if you're a star is, shucks, by golly, he did a bad thing. Well, he should have, you know, the Swallows team president, Mr. Kinugasa, said, we want him to play, and play while assuming a apologetic stance and showing how important, you know, how well he can play, appealing to the fans and the team. They didn't say who he was appealing to, but essentially competing for a job. So if you come in and look apologetic and hit home runs, we're okay with that.
Well, we'll have to see how that plays out. You know, obviously we wish him the best, and we wish the best for his family and everything. Ooh. I just want things to work out for the family stuff. The team, they'll be all right eventually, so I'm not worried about that. All right, let's talk about Hideo Nomo and the other three people who were inducted into the, or who were going to be inducted into the Japanese Baseball Hall of Fame. Nomo is a pioneer of the game who did as much off the field, I think, for the game as he did on the field. With what he did for making players who want to jump to the major leagues. And he's the first Japanese national to be a first ballot Hall of Famer. And I thought that was a big deal.
First Japanese citizen, yeah.
Yeah, the other two were Victor Starfin and Sadaharu Oh, who's of Chinese descent, or Taiwanese, is it?
Well, yeah, I saw that discussion on Twitter. And Oh, of course, was born in Japan. Starfin was born in Russia.
Yeah.
So, but neither were Japanese citizens. Although Starfin may have become a Japanese citizen later in his life, I think he did because he adopted it. I don't know what the story is, but he wasn't allowed to pitch during the Second World War. So, after Russia and Japan began to actually, I don't know this.
Okay, cut that out.
cut that. Okay. Right. So yes, he was the third person to be elected on the first ballot that he was on.
Yep, and the other inductees were Kazuhiro Sasaki, the Daima Gene, mm-hmm. and Koji Akiyama, the backflipping fool. And then
I didn't mention that in my story, interestingly enough, because exuberant. He was exuberant.
Yeah, well, he used to make me very angry just to watch. And
well, I think if you're playing with the Cebu Lions, and they're, you know, they got the the Sabre Lions have a history of managers who's with very high levels of anal retention. And they got another one. They got a throwback this year. So that backflipping makes, you know, is part of the escape mode from that.
Right. The other inductee was Choji Ida. He was a former Waseda University coach, and he was added in a special category. Now, again, passed over, I guess we can say passed over, because they were apparently on the ballot, and I thought they were done being on the ballot, were Greg Boomer Wells and Randy Bass.
Well, they were, and they're on the basically the Japan Hall. To be really brief about this, there's a players election, which is lasts a long time. I think it's 20 years almost. You're on the ballot as long as you get votes,
right?
And the experts panel. Now, if you don't get votes, if you fall out of the players ballot, then you go on to, after a couple of years, you go on to the experts ballot. After you've been retired, I think 25 years, you go on to the experts ballot, and then they rarely select anybody. It's the same process in the U.S. where there's 75% of the vote is required. You need to appear on 75% of the ballots. The experts can vote for coaches and managers and executives and umpires and ball boys and ball dogs.
Hiroshima.
Yeah. We used to have the bulldog. The Marines had a bulldog for one day, but he ran away from the umpire.
All right.
So then they have the other special, every now and then they'll pick a special guy who slips between the cracks, who there's enough support for. And that was the case with Ida, who was instrumental in keeping baseball alive at Waseda University when there was so much pressure against people performing foreign sports. You know, the sports that were made popular by their enemy.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, congratulations to those guys. And we're going to move on since we don't have much time now. I'm starting to get looks from the producer, but we want to talk about one other thing. Was that Nigel Morgan looks like he's going to sign or has signed with the Cleveland Indians. So he won't be back with the base.
Sure. And got a mail the other day from Nigel Morgan. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I'd asked him what was up with him in the Bay Stars, and he didn't answer that question, but he said he was going to take Tiger Spirit to where he was going. I don't know where the Tiger Spirit comes from. Maybe he used to be a Tiger in a previous existence.
All right, well, in this existence, we're going to go to fielding questions. All right, the first is an MP3, and it sounds fantastic. It's from Mike in Washington, D.C. Let's take a listen.
Hey, guys. Last week I was sad to hear the new NPB commissioner was chosen, because my two favorite candidates, John and Jim, were not picked. That being said, if either of you had gotten the job, what would be the first thing that you would do on your first day as commissioner to help the NPB move forward? Thanks, and keep up the great work.
All right, well, thank you, Mike. Go ahead, Jim.
Commissioner John?
I'll let you take that one first, buddy.
Commissioner Jim, well, we have a new commissioner, obviously. Mr. Kumazaki is a prosecutor, and hopefully he won't have anybody arraigned while he's in charge.
Just a few hearings.
I think we can look forward to hearing those. So I think the first thing, I made a long list, and I'm just going to run through it really quick.
All right, well, what's the first thing you would do?
The first thing I would do would be to set up a business office, because certainly – NPB has focused on basically, and this is part of the discussion of the commissioner, and I think this is one of the changes that's going to happen, not because of the commissioner, but because of the Pacific League's insistence on having input into the commissioner's selection.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted a business leader, and as a part of the compromise, there was a discussion about setting up a managing director, basically who will not only have ability to negotiate, he'll also have ability to basically to make deals with people on NPB's behalf, who knows about business and finance and accounting and so on. So that's part of the deal they're going to work on establishing, and I would do that too. I think they need to find ways, somehow, of levering the teams out of the hole they've dug themselves by being independent.
Mm, yeah.
And I think one of the ways it occurred to me was, you know, what the PL marketing is doing. They have to look at that and improve on that. And one of the things they could do, I think I would do, is set up an office. It's going to be called NPB marketing, and it's going to be voluntary. Anybody can sign into it. You know, we're going to put NPB games all over the world.
Right.
You don't have to join. If you don't want to, you don't have to join. We're not going to pressure the Giants to join this. But if they're not, it means their games won't be shown in NPB marketing.
Right.
They'll appear as visitors, but they won't appear as the home team, and they'll get none of the profits from that.
Okay.
So joint marketing and joint licensing. That's the first thing I would do.
Okay. The first thing I would do, and I think we've talked about it on the show before, but I'd get the website in order in English and then set up an internet streaming plan with apps that can generate some revenue. And that, so it'll allow people to watch on their mobile devices, and they'll have to pay, just like an at-bat kind of an app in the States where you can watch all the games or any game or replays of games at any time you want on demand, except for the live games. But of course you got live streaming, and I think that'll generate a lot of revenue and get, just like as you said, if you can get all the teams together and all the teams doing the same thing and pulling in the same direction, that all the clubs can generate revenue. Whether it's significant or not, we'll have to see how that plays out, but I think it can actually generate revenue. And I think the biggest thing is it gets everyone pulling in the same direction, which they're not now. They're all independent, and that's not good for the league.
I'm all with that.
All right. One other thing, or a couple other items you had on your list, because I guess on the field, I would have the umps enforce the rule on the when there's no runners on base and the pitcher has to deliver his next pitch within 10 seconds. I'd have the umpires enforce that.
Sure. I think enforcing the rules is one, and I think the other thing is if I were Japan, I'd go to MLB and IBAF and say, look, guys, we have a problem. Now, baseball basically has, for the most part, with the exception of MLB and working to eliminate unnecessary home plate collisions, which was radical, baseball has been very much of the point of, we don't need to fix it if nobody is going to pressure us to.
Mm.
So essentially, the only drastic changes baseball has seen to any of its rules was the IBAF's decision to become softball for the sake of the Olympic Games. Now, I'm not arguing that speed up and tiebreaker rule is a good or a bad thing, but the idea is that we can change if somebody pressures us to. I think the IBAF and MLB and NPB and KBO and Chinese baseball and, you know, maybe the Dutch Federation as well, because they're fairly big amateur players in Australia where they have leagues. They need to get together and say, what can we do to make the game better? And anybody who says, we need to play faster, just hit them with a stick. Because they basically play faster doesn't help, because the rules are set up so that it encourages teams to play more slowly.
Mm.
And until you change the rules, like you're just saying, no, this is something we don't need because anyway, they need to basically eliminate rules that are doing no good. They're only slowing down the game. And I, of course, my favorite one is bringing in these 1-point relievers, because nobody's paying to see the 25th or 26th best guy on your roster, the guy who wouldn't have a job if he wasn't left-handed.
Yeah.
And nobody's coming to the park saying, boy, I wish I could see Bob so-and-so pitch against one batter because it's strategically important.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that's my thing. I think they need to look at rules that they could eliminate and return a lot of the speed and edge to the game that it's missing through all this, normal competitive nonsense that managers do. And they have to do it because the other guy's doing it.
Yeah, gamesmanship. All right, yeah. Our next question is from Claudio in Toronto. Hey, buddy, Happy New Year. He says, I'd like to hear your feedback on reading the baseball section of the Japanese sports newspapers in January. Isn't it thrilling? He gave some examples like, you know, three players left out of Narita Airport for workouts in Guam. A veteran player dropped 2 kilograms during his workout in his trip to the U.S., blah, blah, blah. They're really, really boring. They're stupid. Claudio, this is nothing new. I mean, the dearth of news is quite evident, and if a guy stays too long in the restroom, it's a news item on a non-Ballantine, non-Japan national team uniforms were stolen from the office kind of a day. When camp starts, they actually count the batting practice pitches, and they write about how many of the swings the player hit looked like potential hits.
Yeah, how many home runs a guy has hit in batting practice.
Right. When camp starts, in batting practice, you get how many home runs. I mean, Yuki Matsui of the rookie for the Rakuten Eagles was on a treadmill, and that was the cover picture for one of the daily sports papers. And I mean, there's nothing to write about, so they have to print stories about nothing. And I can't say it's any worse than a typical year.
No, it's pretty much, in fact, it's very much like the season, except the nothing that occurs is happening out of the context of competition. You know, during the season, essentially they've got all these beat writers and they've got to do something.
And they've got all these pages to fill.
You know, they can't run full pages of Yuki Matsui on the treadmill every day.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a big item. Yuki Matsui on the treadmill.
Beat the treadmill.
Yeah. So is what happens.
This is what it's like as a pro. Get on your treadmill, buddy.
And we're going to have to get on our treadmill because I do see the producer, and who's talking to your agent, by the way, but he's giving me the eye.
Yeah, we got to keep those two apart.
Yeah. He's giving me the eye, so we got to get out of here. It's a long show. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the end. Thanks again to Jerry Krasnick, and we will see you next time in a couple weeks.
All right. Looking forward to your questions and feedback.
All right. Enjoy your baseball, everyone.
Bye.